The Manitoba Association of Christian Homeschools would like to thank the Learning House for sponsoring this recording.
Well, hello. Back again. So this is Teaching Science at Home, and teaching is in quotation marks. That's pretty important. And I use this picture very intentionally. It's cute. First of all, if you can't tell what the young lady's doing, she's got one of those little magnifying glasses, and she's using it like a monocle. That's kind of cute. But this is her father learning earth science right along with her. That's what teaching is in the homeschooling community. It's not necessarily you knowing any more than your child. It's just, in this case, him and his child learning earth science together. And that's wonderful. Now, that's one of the big benefits of being a homeschooler. And that's why teaching is in quotes. You may know the science, but you'll learn something new along the way. And most likely a lot of you will learn a lot of science. And, you know, at least some of you will come away saying, you know, I actually kind of like science. I wonder why I didn't like it when I was in school. Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. So there are notes available. In this talk, I'm going to be talking about a lot of specific curriculum, my curriculum, but lots of other curriculum as well. And so in the notes, I have, you know, websites and so forth that you can go to learn more about each of those curricula. So go to my website. If you're using a phone, you got to click on menu. If you're using a computer, click on my name and then click on handouts. And you can like me on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so just so you know a little bit about why I do this, I talked a little bit about it in the keynote, so I'm not going to labor much of these points, but nevertheless, I started my career thinking I would be, actually, I started my career as a professional actor. That was my first gig. When I realized I loved acting for fun and I hated acting for a living, I thought, well, what am I going to do? Well, I had done a lot of special effects on stage using chemistry. So I thought, well, I'll study chemistry. And it turns out I really liked chemistry, so I stuck with it. Well, anyway, when I got my degree and got my PhD, I thought I was just going to be a university professor doing research. That's what I was going to do with my life. So as part of that, I actually helped develop what I thought was a very innovative program at the time. It was called the Indiana Academy for Science, Mathematics, and Humanities. And anything with that long a name has to be good, right? Right? It was a boarding school for gifted and talented students run by the state. So if you thought your child was gifted and you wanted to get rid of your child for the last 2 years of high school, you can apply to this program, and if they were deemed gifted, they would come to the Ball State University campus, where I was a professor, and they would take a blend of courses, either university courses they were ready for or high school courses designed specifically for gifted and talented students. And I was brought in to design the chemistry and physics curriculum that they used at the time. It was a very innovative program, but it was ridiculously wasteful, like pretty much anything government is, and it didn't deliver on most of its promises. But nevertheless, when you're a professor, you expand the knowledge in your field, which for a scientist means doing experiments and discovering new things. Well, doing experiments and discovering new things costs money. So you have to find somebody to give you money to do this. So my research was sponsored by the National Science Foundation, which is a tax-supported institution. So if any of you ever paid U.S. taxes in the 90s, thank you very much for your contributions in helping me research things that A, you couldn't care less about, and B, have no practical value whatsoever. And that's where I got interested in homeschooling, talked about in the keynote. My best university students were homeschool graduates. And this specifically, these were science students. So my best chemistry and physics students were homeschool graduates. So homeschoolers do really well with science, despite the fact what you may feel about how you're doing with science. On average, homeschoolers do really well with science. They really do. And so it was the scientists that you guys, that homeschoolers raised up, that made me start working with homeschoolers. Right now, I write homeschool curriculum. I'm also a professor at Memoria College. I teach mostly master level stuff. So anyway, that's just a little bit about me so that you know where I'm coming from on this issue. I'm a homeschool advocate because I saw the products early on. You know, and it hasn't changed. Even to this day, my best university students are the homeschool graduates. So That's really good. All right, so when we're talking about teaching science at home, the first thing you have to do is you have to relax. Because simply by homeschooling your children, you're giving them an advantage in sciences. And that might sound really weird to you, but in fact, all of the data say this. So for example, if I look at the ACT, that's taken here in Canada and in the US for college entrance or university entrance, and it has a science reasoning section on it. On average, homeschool graduates score about 22 on the ACT science section compared to about 21 for the overall average of all students, all college, university student bound students who take this test. Now that doesn't sound like a lot of difference, but the ACT scale gets very compressed, especially right towards the average. That little difference there is actually 10 percentile points. So on average, homeschoolers produce students who are 10 percentile points higher in science than other university-bound students. Now, here's the real interesting part about that. The ACT does not test how much science you know. I've actually written questions for the ACT, so they're very clear about what they want. Any science facts the student needs to know has to be in the narrative that describes the problem. What the ACT is trying to test is how well you can reason scientifically. So basically, you give the student a narrative of experiments that are done or observations that are made, and then you ask them questions about what can be concluded. And you're trying to find if they can make the correct conclusions from the given data. So this tells us that homeschoolers produce better scientific reasoners than the rest of the population. And I can tell you why. I honestly can. It's not a mystery to me. And that is, homeschoolers are still the ones who use that archaic method of phonics to teach reading. Phonics is the first student's first introduction to deductive reasoning. Because what is phonics? It's a list of a bunch of facts, how these letters sound. Once you know those facts, you can arrange those facts together to conclude what the word means. That's deductive reasoning. And so many schools don't teach that anymore. They teach sight reading, see and say method. You memorize words, essentially. That's the common way most schools teach reading. So homeschoolers are still teaching deductive reasoning early on because they're teaching phonics. If you ask specifically how much science do homeschoolers know, at that point then the homeschoolers really take off. Depending on what study I look at, what region of the US, what parts of Canada I look at, the lowest score I've seen for the average performance of homeschool students on standardized K through 12 science test is 68%. The highest I've seen is 88%. It's a pretty broad range, but the average is 50%. These standardized tests that are used in these kinds of studies, they're scored so that the average is always 50% no matter what. So in the end, homeschoolers are somewhere between 18 and 38 percentile points ahead of the mean when it comes to how much science they know. Now, that has a very specific application to you. Let's suppose you're a lousy homeschooler, right? There've got to be some, right? There are the really great ones whose kids are quoting Shakespeare at 9, right? And then there are the other ones, right? So there got to be some lousy homeschoolers out there. If you're a lousy homeschooler, that means you're not going to be able to score, your kid's not going to score 68. And if you're really, really, really lousy, you might get them as low as 50%, at which point they're on par with everybody else. Because you can actually ask this question another way. Now, not all of these studies have enough information because what they publish isn't always everything. But for the studies that I've seen that make up these numbers that have the right information, I can look at it another way. I can say, okay, these are all averages. But let me ask this question. Of all the homeschool students, what percentage of them score at least 50? So what percentage of homeschoolers are at the average or above? And the answer, roughly 90%. Roughly 90% of homeschoolers are at least average or above. So as long as you're not in the bottom 10% of homeschooling, you're giving your child at least an equivalent education. So relax. Really, your child has a leg up simply because you're choosing to do the hard work and actually homeschooling your child. Okay, with that little pep talk out of the way, the most important thing you have to know about science education is that science isn't the most important thing. Math is. By far, mathematics is the most important part of giving your child a good science education, because mathematics is a disciplined way of thinking that applies to science. And you start teaching mathematics right away. You can teach scientific facts right away, but you don't teach science until they've got a bunch of facts that they can start synthesizing. You start teaching math as soon as they start counting. So you teach scientific reasoning initially by teaching math. Alexander the Great once said, "Diplomacy without arms is like music without instruments." And I say science without math is like music without instruments. You just can't have one without the other. Now, don't mistake what I'm saying here. You do not have to be good at math to be good at science. If you believe what Einstein wrote in his personal letters, he said his worst subject was math. I really have a hard time believing that, but that's what he said, right? But he realized that to understand science fully, he had to understand math as well as he could. When he got his first regular professorship, he did something that was unheard of at the time. He saw that the university he was a professor in had more math courses than the universities he was at, so he actually sat in on those math courses with the students. Because even though he said, "Math, I'm not really good at math," he knew he had to be experienced in math. That's what we're looking for. We want the student to be experienced in math, because the more you struggle with math, the more you're training your brain to think like a scientist. So every day in homeschool, here's what you have to think about. If I can do reading, writing, and math, it's a good day. Those are the three things you've got to try and hit every day. And you won't hit them every day, but those are the three things you want to try. Everything else, including science, is icing on the cake. Because those three things, reading and writing, is how you're going to learn more. And math is training your brain. Those are the three things you got to hit every day, if you can. All right, so when we get to the icing on the cake, when we do have time to do a little science, what do we do? Well, in the early years, in the K through 6 science education, the first and most important thing is keep it light. Students don't need to learn a lot of science in elementary school, right? But that doesn't mean you make it simple. Light and simple are two different things. Light is how much volume you're going to do. How many scientific facts do they know? How many $20 vocabulary words do they need to learn? That's how light or heavy it is, right? Simple is, avoiding being simple is avoiding making the science so dumbed down that it's not right anymore. So you want to give your child, even in the elementary school, children can grasp difficult things if you let them try. Right? So in the end, don't go for the oversimplified stuff. Just don't try and cover too much at any given time. Once again, you got to stress the math over the science. Math wins every time if there's a decision that needs to be made. And this is where you emphasize discovery. So there's this kind of view these days in science that in order to learn science, you've got to do labs. That's false, and I don't know really where that came from. Certainly the way we learned science was to do labs, and it took us a mere 3,000 years. Most students don't have that much time. So in the end, students aren't going to learn by doing experiments. Nevertheless, in the early years, you have the most freedom. So that's when you want to do a lot of stuff with your hands. Right? And that doesn't necessarily even mean doing experiments. It means going out in nature, getting your fingers dirty, turning over rocks, you know, seeing what's there, drawing what's there, and trying to figure out what you saw after you drew it, right? So that's what I mean by discovery. It's not so much reading books. It's doing things that help you understand the natural world more and how it works. And I'm going to give you some examples of what I mean in a second. Here's the most important, the most important thing is math always wins. The second most important thing in K through 6 is there's no set subjects to cover. You could spend 6 years studying bugs, and that's fine with me. Because in the end, elementary science isn't about getting through a certain amount of information and being prepared to go on. Elementary science is about learning how the world works, and the world works the same for bugs as it does for chemicals. So in the end, find what's interesting to the students and do that. And eventually they'll get bored. You know, I was crazy about dinosaurs for a couple years. I got over it, right? So in the end, they'll get bored after a couple years. But honestly, they can do as much as they want on any given subject, and that will be fine. Because there isn't some set of topics. In the business, we say that elementary science is not content specific, which means there's nothing you absolutely have to cover in elementary science. My experience with students going on to junior high and high school and university, enthusiasm for the subject is much more important than what they know about it. And it's so easy to lose a student's enthusiasm by forcing them to memorize the binomial names of birds and things like that. Don't let that happen. If they're into that, there are some students who love to memorize stuff, great. But the idea is follow their interest, keep them enthused. That's much more important than covering some set level of curriculum. All right, now, in the elementary years and overall, there are two basic approaches to teaching science, and you've probably seen these before. One is called the spiral approach. So you learn a little bit about birds, and you learn a little bit about flowers, and then the next year you learn a little bit about a few other things, and a couple years later, you come back and learn about birds and flowers again. So you review what you learned already about birds and flowers, and then you learn a little more. That's the spiral method, because you keep spiraling back to the same topics over and over again. The immersion approach is you learn as much as you possibly can about a subject for maybe a semester, maybe a whole year, and then you move on, and you may never see it again, right? But for that 1 year or half a year, you spend as much of your time as you can learning about that. That's the immersion approach. Well, they both have their strengths and their weaknesses. So the high schools and universities use the immersion approach because the argument is, if I use the immersion approach, I can cover more. And even though I might forget it in 3 or 4 years, that's fine. If I learned it once, it's fairly easy to review and learn again. So if I need to find out that binomial name of the bird, I can look it up, figure it out pretty easily. But I don't have to keep it on to the top of my head. Spiral approach can be a little repetitive, and many students find it boring, but it keeps everything on top of your head. So in other words, you have a much higher level of recall. Typically, students can recall facts much more quickly if they've done it in the spiral approach than if they've done science in the immersion approach. So immersion approach gets you through more stuff. Spiral approach gives you more recall and things like that. Most students find spiral a little more boring. And also there's a sort of natural tendency we as humans have. If I learn something, I'm then an expert on it. So I learn about birds and flowers the first time, and when it comes back to birds and flowers, there's nothing more to learn. I'm already an expert on it. Why do I need to learn this again? Right? So you kind of have to fight that if you're doing the spiral approach. That's kind of a downside. But most elementary books, especially written for schools, are written in the spiral approach because it does produce good recall, and recall is something that some schools think is really, really important. All right. Now, I have a different approach, and it's the best one, of course. And I honestly don't know. I found it really interesting, so I did it. It's basically learning science in the order it was learned in history. So you start off, and you can't start right away learning what we learned in history because these ancient Greeks were pretty smart people. So you need a little bit of basis of knowledge. So The first book covers the days of creation and gives you a sort of a general overview of science and everything that that's been created. And then you start with the ancient Greeks and you simply learn science as it was learned in history. And what you learn about science, if you do it that way, is science is basically the story of one guy coming up with an idea that's almost completely wrong, and then lots of other guys throughout the generations continually refining that idea to make it less wrong. And that's what science is. Science is the continual work at taking a wrong idea and making it less wrong. That's really what it's all about. So you can follow the entire series if you want. There are 15 lessons in every section. There are 6 sections per book, so that's 90 lessons. But 3 of them are optional. They're called challenge lessons. So you could do as little as 72 lessons in a year. That would be doing science twice a week. Or 90 lessons in a year, which would be doing science every other day. Every lesson has a hands-on activity. This could be good or bad, depending on you and your students, right? So some students love to do hands-on activities, and some parents hate to do them. So you have to decide what works for your situation, whether that's a good idea or not. Every lesson has 3 levels of review, so that all of your K-6 kids do the same lesson, and then they just split up for different reviews based on how old they are. And all of my stuff, if you buy any of my books, in the introduction, there's a website you can go to. You can ask me questions. All right. This isn't your only option. This isn't only your only good option. There are a lot of other great options as well. So one of the standard options out there are the Abeka and Bob Jones series. Now, these are written in the spiral approach. They're written for, you know, private schools in the U.S., and for homeschoolers, they are the tried and true. They're pretty much the things that have been available the longest to homeschoolers. There was a time, however, where neither of these companies would sell to homeschoolers. And it wasn't that they hated homeschoolers. It's that they didn't understand how you could make money selling books one at a time. Because they always sold to schools. Dozens of books at a time, right? Well, they figured out how to make money selling books one at a time, because they do it now. And they do it really well. So these are really nice books. In the elementary years, they're very usable, very easy. As you go on, and we're going to get to junior high and high school in a minute, as you go on, they get harder and harder to use, because they really do expect there's a teacher there to really explain the rough stuff. But early on, it's not too bad. Now, one thing is, most of the hands-on activities, if they're there in these books, aren't really made for home. But that's okay, because there's lots of ways to fix this. This is something you can do regardless of what curriculum, even if you don't do a curriculum at all. There are a whole series of books by Janice Van Cleve, and they all start something for every kid. So the one in the picture is biology for every kid. She's got physics for every kid, weather for every kid, earth science for every kid. And all it is a bunch of very simple experiments that you can do at home. And so if you're using a curriculum that doesn't have experiments, or you don't want to do a curriculum, you just want to have some hands-on activities, these are great books. You don't even have to buy them. Every library has these, because it's just a very popular resource for science education. So you go to your local library. I know some people still go to libraries. You go to your local library, you'll find a shelf that has Janice Van Cleve books, almost certainly. There are some others out there. One 2 book set that I really like is called Developing Critical Thinking Through Science. It's a 2 book set. The one book is for younger kids and the other book is for older kids, but they're all elementary. And they're through critical thinking books and software. And once again, it's just very simple activities you can do to do science reasoning and things like that. So this could be used to supplement a curriculum, or it could be used just to do some experiments, you know, for even if you're not following a curriculum. All right. Now, there are, of course, some curriculums made specifically for elementary kids that are homeschooled. Answers in Genesis has the God's Design 4 series. It's designed for homeschooled students. It has activities that can be done at home. It has study questions and tests and all of that kind of stuff. It is immersion approach. Each book is about one specific thing. Now, there are several books, and you can mix and match to make more of a spiral approach to it. The only problem with these books is they have one set of tests, and tests are very grade specific. So I would, I would say that the tests are around the fifth grade level. That's where I would put the tests at. But if you've never looked at that, that might be something to look at. Apologia has a wonderful series. The author is Jeannie Fulbright. Some people think I wrote these books. I don't know why. I wrote the older books for Apologia early on, but I never wrote elementary with Apologia. These are by Jeannie Fulbright. The Swimming Creatures of the Fifth Day and the Flying Creatures and all that, that's all Jeannie Fulbright. She's got a wonderful writing style. She makes these living books. These are the kind of books you sit on the couch and read aloud, you know, and it's a whole family experience. She's very big on the Charlotte Mason method. Their immersion approach, they're designed for all of your K through 6 kids to listen to the same lesson and do the same activities and things like that. The experiments are home friendly. A lot of her experiments are more crafty. Like if you do Swimming Creatures of the Fifth Day, which is the book in the end there, you learn first about like the structure of the ocean, and so you make a diorama box that shows the structure of the ocean, and then every time you learn about a new class of creatures, you add that to your diorama box. So by the time you're done, you have, you know, sort of a box of all the things you learned about that year, and that's really cool. It's more crafty than experimenting. Excuse me, but still really cool. it's very easy to understand. She has a very pleasant, easy writing style, and she loves science, and that comes through in her work really well. There's a course website that gives more advanced information and things like that. So that's a really good choice for your series. There is one book in this series that's not written by her. It's the Earth Science book. I'm not quite sure why, but there's a different author for that book, and I don't find it nearly as good as Jeannie's books. So I would probably avoid the Earth Science if it were me. All right, so there are a lot of options there. You got mine, which is obviously the best option. you got Bob Jones, Abeka, Answers in Genesis, Apologia. And in fact, you don't have to use any curriculum. As long as you are good enough at figuring out how to keep your kids inquisitive about science, you don't have to follow a curriculum for that. If you send them outside to turn over a couple of rocks, draw what they see, and get them to find something that interests them that you can then go to the library or go to the internet and learn more about, that's science. And you don't need a curriculum for that at all, right? All it is about getting your students to be inquisitive about how nature works and learn more about how nature works. So how do you choose among all these? Well, think about your children's interests and personalities. You know, which ones really like to do experiments, which ones would rather sit and listen to you, read to them, things like that. Think about the time you have available. That makes a big difference, of course. Think about what's practical in your environment. If you live in a big city, you're not going to do a lot of stuff where you have to go outside and investigate that kind of thing. So you do have to think about those things. But the key is these are all good choices. Because in the elementary years, as long as you can keep them interested, you're doing well. That's the real goal. That doesn't mean don't do anything, right? It just means keep them interested, learning more about the world around them, but in little bite-sized chunks. It doesn't have to be specific. It doesn't have to be systematic. However, once you go on to junior high school, then things have to be a little more systematic, because now we approach the content-specific years, the years where you have to learn specific things. At that point, you really do need a curriculum. Early on, it can be a lot more inquisitive-based. It can be a lot more activity-based. But at some point, you have to start using a curriculum to get them the more detailed information. So you really have to start finding something that works for you. Some of the things I've already talked about have middle school options. So like God's Design 4 can actually continue through eighth grade. Apologia has
a seventh and eighth grade curriculum that you can use as well. So there are, we have a, I have a seventh and eighth grade curriculum you can have. So there are plenty of options for you. But there are a couple of, there's at least one other that now shows up that wasn't in any of the others. There's a company called the, or there's a program called the Rainbow. It is not New Age. nothing like that. The Rainbow's a good thing, right? And it's grade 7 and 8 only. It's the immersion, it uses the immersion approach. It's two courses, one for every year. It's very discovery-oriented, lots of experiments to do, and they're all home-friendly. There's a kit that he sells you that makes it very, very easy to use. The kit includes pretty much everything but water. So it's a very, very easy system to use. It's a bit more understandable than most school books, but not quite as understandable as, say, Jeannie Fulbright's books. He's not quite as good an author as she is when it comes to explaining difficult things. The number of topics covered in this seventh and eighth grade is a little lower than you'll find in most junior high and high school, but it's made up for by the good hands-on experiments. So that's a really good option. Their website is beginningspublishing.com. And once again, that's in the notes that I talked about at the beginning. So you can look into that. That's a nice option for you when you get to seventh and eighth grade. Not surprisingly, I like my seventh and eighth grade courses. I know that's kind of a shock. We enjoy them, and that picture I showed at the beginning is from the kid doing the earth science book. All right, in high school, math becomes even more important because in the end, math determines what you can actually study. Because at that point, there are certain specific things you need to know about math in order to do science. In high school biology, this is important in the U.S., metric units. We're still ancient, right? So not a problem for you guys, problem for us. But once you get into chemistry, there are specific algebraic and arithmetic concepts you have to know. Now, this is covered in almost everybody's curriculum up through and including Algebra 1. Some of these aren't algebra at all, but they're really, really important. So for example, if you look on the screen there, if I multiply two fractions, and I have the same number in the numerator of one and the denominator of the other, they cancel. Yeah, hopefully you've seen that, right? That's real easy, real simple way to make fraction multiplication very simple. In fact, right there, that's about 30% of high school chemistry. And it's about 25% of high school physics. If you can not only understand that, but actually arrange things so that that happens. So it's just fractions, it's just higher level arithmetic, but nevertheless, if you know this well, it's a big jump in understanding basic chemistry and basic physics. You need to know how positive and negative numbers add, subtract, multiply, and divide. You need to know how to multiply and divide numbers that have exponents. So when I multiply like 10 squared by 10 cubed, those exponents add, so the product is 10 to the fifth. That's important for something called scientific notation. And so you'll need to know that. Here's the thing that really makes students hate chemistry. And that is, you have to know basic algebra. So this is the chemist's favorite equation. We call it the pervert equation. And it explains how a gas behaves under ideal conditions. P is pressure, so you measure that with like a barometer. V is volume, you measure that with a ruler, length times width times height. R is a physical constant, never changes, you just look that up in a book. T is temperature, you measure that with a thermometer. Here's the cool thing though. You rearrange that equation so that it turns into N equals PV over RT, and that's basic algebra to do that. N is the number of moles, which tells you how many atoms are there. Now, you can't see atoms, but with a barometer, a ruler, and a thermometer, you can count them. Isn't that incredible? Counting something you can't see with very simple tools. That's the beauty of that equation, but you only can do that if you understand the algebra. right? You also have to be able to read and understand graphs. The vertical axis is called the dependent variable. The horizontal is the independent variable. There are reasons for that. So those are the things you need to know. If you can do all of that, you can understand high school chemistry. If you can't do all of that, you either fail a real high school chemistry course or you take some dumbed down Fisher-Price version, which isn't really chemistry. So in the end, you don't want to expose your child to chemistry until they finished Algebra 1, because otherwise you're just setting them up for failure. If you go on and take physics, it gets better or worse, depending on your point of view, because at that point you have to know basic trigonometry. You have to know what a sine, a cosine, and a tangent are, and how they're defined on a right triangle. This is usually covered in geometry. However, Saxon covers it in his Algebra 2. So it depends a little bit on, but basically, you need to find where your child is learning about right triangles, sine, cosine, and tangent. After that, they're ready for physics, because this forms the basis of vector addition. And physics without vectors is a lie. So you got to learn vectors if you're going to learn physics. All right, I'll tell you what advanced means in a minute. If you take advanced chemistry, you need to be finished with Algebra 2, because you need to know what a logarithm is. Logarithms are really weird, but they're an important part of nature, an important part of advanced chemistry. I'll tell you what advanced means in a minute again, but advanced physics, you need to have finished pre-calculus. You don't have to take calculus yet, but you need to have gone through pre-calculus. Everybody else in the world calls that pre-calculus. For some reason, Saxon calls it advanced math. All right, if you put all of this together, here's what you've got. This is the way I see you scheduling high school science. All right, first of all, you want to see if you can get them through biology, chemistry, and physics by the time they graduate. Now, that's already a high bar. I don't know what the statistics are here in Canada. In the US, only 19% of graduating high school seniors have had all three. So that's already a high bar. But the reason you want to do that is because biology, chemistry, and physics compose the three branches that basically hold all the other branches of science. And so by giving them those three branches of science, you've exposed them to a little bit of everything. I know many of my colleagues who can't stand biology, can barely tolerate chemistry, but love physics. Right? You just don't know what your child's going to like until you expose your child to it. You may think you do, but honestly, you don't. So if you honestly think your child's going to hate science, make sure he hates each individual science on its own merit. That's the reason you're trying to expose. Now, I'll tell you, my daughter did not get through physics. She did about a semester of physics in 1 year. Right, so she didn't get through all of it. So she got through, you know, all of biology, all of chemistry, about half of physics. So doesn't work for everybody, but that's your overall goal. And that could take all 4 years of high school. And you're still better off than most people in terms of your science experience. All right, if your child is not science oriented, they're done, right? And you could either if they finish before their senior year, that's great, or you can let it stretch out over 4 years or whatever. If your child is science-oriented, that's the other column, there you want to give them a little more. Biology, chemistry, and physics, when done right, are what we call university preparation courses. They prepare the student to learn it properly at university. Usually that's by covering about 60% of what you're going to see in the university course. That way, when you get to the university course, you only have to worry about that difficult 40%. That makes it a little more manageable, right? In the student's senior year, the student can pick whichever one he or she liked the best and take a second year of it. That's the advanced version. That fills in the gap and gives you the rest of what you'd get your first year of university. That's what advanced means. You may have heard the term advanced placement or CLEP. That's what that means. There are two tests. One's called the advanced placement test. The other's called the CLEP test. And those, basically, if you pass those, you have demonstrated proficiency in the first year of university in that subject. So in the end, that's your goal for students who's science-oriented. Get them through the basics so that then their senior year they can specialize. The big red star is just because in some math programs, you may not see that trigonometry until the junior year. If that's the case, pull physics into the senior year and do advanced biology or advanced chemistry if the student needs to wait a little bit before the math catches up. Because you definitely don't want to do physics until you've seen that trigonometry. All right, so that's the overall goal. And when you look at it that way and you realize that just getting through biology, chemistry, and physics is a big deal, and that can take all 4 years, it's not nearly as bad as it sounds, right? So it's not that bad. Your student's math level is what drives this. So in the end, I think freshman year, your freshman year math course is algebra. So I think algebra and biology pair very well together. So for some students, that might be seventh grade, and that's fine. If they're really ready for algebra, they could really, really be ready for biology. Now, you know your student better than me, so this is just a rule of thumb, but nevertheless. But the other way applies as well. If they don't get to algebra until 11th grade, they shouldn't do biology until 11th grade, because the math level is some indication of where they are scientifically as well. So that's gives you kind of a rough idea there. Once again, for high school, there are Bob Jones and Abeka. Those get very hard to use because they expect the teacher knows the subject. And so they become harder and harder to use for a parent who doesn't know the subject. For most school textbooks, the explanation is very sparse. It's not enough for most students. The labs generally don't work at home. And most parents don't know what parts of the book to skip. In a typical high school chemistry book, there are 30, 35 chapters. You should cover about 25 to 30 of them. But how many you skip depends on what you know, right? And so if you don't know what to skip, you don't know where what to leave out and what not to. So stuff that's designed for schools don't really work very well at homeschool unless you've got somebody who knows the subject available to you. But there are some other options. And this is a really interesting program. It's called the In Your Home series. If these were available when I was homeschooling my daughter, I would have used these for her instead of mine, because these are things where you have to investigate the answers for yourself. So basically, the book that the student gets has a bunch of very carefully selected questions that the student has to answer. And the student simply does research until he or she finds the answer. And the way it is in order to find that answer, they're going to have to learn enough about that topic to actually become proficient in it. Now, you've got the answers, so you don't have to worry about that, but they have to research out the answers. There are experiments that can be done at home as long as you've got the kits, and they do sell the kits for it and everything. And it's very open-ended. For a student who finds something very interesting, they can go a long way using this curriculum. So it's a very interesting curriculum to look at. The average student will not go as deeply as they would in most other books, but the interested student will go a lot more deeply. So that may be something to work with. Their website is scienceforhighschool.com, but if you just Google science, quote, in your home, end quote, you're gonna find it. And so that's very good. It will be very nice for students who like to seek out the answers to questions rather than being simply told what the answers are. Now, of course, I'm gonna like my stuff. You know, my stuff is upstairs. You can take a look at it. Lots of experiments. Once again, you need kits. Not all of them require kits, but most of them do. Very rigorous. This is university preparatory material, so some students will just find it too much, and that's understandable. Not nearly as many pictures as you find in a lot of books, because I've got to explain things, and that takes words. So in the end, they're not quite as pretty or as flashy as a lot of curriculum that you find. Also, there's another series out there. I would not recommend this for science-oriented students, but this is high school level for the not science-oriented students. It's called the 101 series. I don't know why the H is capitalized. That should just be the beginning of a website, https://. So or you can just put in the101series.com and you'll get it. It's DVD, so it's a video class, but the fourth DVD does have a PDF that you print out, so you do have instruction by paper as well. So the instruction is mostly by video, but there is a PDF you print out and follow as well. It's got tests, it's got experiments, it's got everything. It is not rigorous enough if the student's planning to go on and study science, but if you're not, this is a really nice way of getting the basics at the high school level without overwhelming your student too much. I would be surprised if Heritage Resources doesn't carry this, but it is, I mean, Amazon has it and everybody, so you can get it fairly easy if you need to. So that's a nice alternative if you're really not, if you don't think your child's going to be science-oriented. Okay, I still have 10 minutes, and I think, that is it. Any questions I can answer here? Yes, ma'am, go ahead. So if you didn't hear, the student's done some spiral stuff, a lot of spiral stuff all the way through junior high, doesn't want to do high school biology, wants to do chemistry, physics, and then something advanced in either chemistry or physics. My concern is most universities want to see a life science. And so, here's what you could do to not game the system, but this would work. If you take chemistry, physics, and then biochemistry, that would work, right? Because the biochemistry is a life science. You know, it's the chemistry specifically devoted to life. So I think there are ways you can do that, but you've got to do something that can be legitimately listed as a high school life science. As a chemist and physicist, I'd say go ahead and forget biology, but universities don't like to see that. And honestly, you want your, I know your student's done spiral, so he's done a lot of biology. He knows enough to know he doesn't like it. But nevertheless, that's not enough for a university. And if university isn't in the future, then it doesn't matter. But you don't want to limit their options. Yeah. Another question. Yes. So what grade's he in now? I'm going to have to come down for this. Hopefully it doesn't feedback too much. So what grade's he in now? Grade 5 math, right. So I do think I definitely would wait at least a year. He's in grade 7, but he's in grade 5 math. I would wait at least another, wait till he's in pre-algebra and see if he can do biology in while he's doing pre-algebra, because that'll be kind of close, you know, and be willing to say, okay, no, we've gone a little too fast. So be willing to punt back a little bit. But there are, you know, you can, I don't know what you've done so far, but there are, middle school programs that don't do the math yet. My science in the atomic age doesn't do the math, things like that. Yeah. So yeah, if you, like my science in the atomic age doesn't do any math, and even my discovering design with science, it's just that fraction stuff. Because I'm getting ready for chemistry in a couple of years, so it does that fraction stuff. And that's the earth science course. So I think there'll be stuff for you to do waiting. But yeah, I would definitely, the earliest I would try and do biology is with pre-algebra. Yeah. At least I can be down here. Any other questions? It's just there's some really good conversation going on right behind there. Okay, I don't see any. Going once, going twice. All right, I will be up in the exhibit hall, and I have a keynote tonight. Thank you very much.